Chapter 2. Euclidean Geometry. Origins of Geometry. The cultures that grew up in the arid region of Mesopotamia within the Tigris-Euphrates river system from the 4th millennium BC needed to tackle problems which we would now call geometrical. Dividing and surveying the land after periodic floods relied on measuring distances and computing areas. Development of trade required the Mesopotamian merchants to measure the quantity of grain in cylindrical or spherical containers. The early methods varied from imperfect to precise. Areas of quadrilaterals were computed by multiplying the averages of the opposite sides. This gives the right answer for rectangles, but not for trapezia, quadrilaterals with only one pair of parallel sides. The Egyptians could calculate the volume of a square pyramid, like the Great Pyramid of Giza, constructed around 2500 BC. They could also accurately calculate the volume of the cylinder as the product of its height and the area of its base. The rules of these computations were established empirically, and their correctness was measured by accuracy. The proofs were neglected. The geometrical statements were not meant to be absolutely exact, but only sufficiently good approximations. For example, the Mesopotamians took the value of pi to be 3, although they most likely realized that this was only an approximation. If you draw a circle and then place successive chords of length equal to that of the radius, then after 6 steps, you will construct a hexagon and come back to the starting point. This gives the formula circumference equals 3 multiplied by diameter, which cannot be right for a circle, as it is exactly right for the hexagon inscribed inside the circle. What then is the exact proportionality factor, pi, between the circumference and the diameter of a circle? Does such a number even exist? There is no evidence that these questions occupied the Mesopotamians any more than they occupy the 21st century school exam boards which quote pi to be 3.14, or the manufacturers of 8-digit calculators which give 3.14159926. Whilst we know little about the origins of geometry, it is safe to assume that the Greeks learnt it, in its utilitarian form, from the Egyptians in around the 6th century BC. The Greek merchant and mathematician Thales of Miletus, 640 to 546 BC, used the similarity of triangles to measure the height of the Great Pyramid of Giza by comparing the length of its shadow to the length of the shadow of a stick. He is credited with the first application of deductive methods. The ancient Greek philosophers were not concerned with the practical applications of geometry, but rather with its relations to the absolute truth. They devised deductive and axiomatic methods to study the properties of volumes, areas, and distances. These methods have changed little in the past 2,500 years, so Greek geometry is where our story should begin. Axioms and deduction. Euclidean geometry lies at the heart of geometry. It forms what we might call geometric intuition and gives a very accurate description of the space around us. While the ancient Egyptians were familiar with geometry, they did not distinguish between abstract concepts and real objects. Thus, a line segment connecting two points could have meant a piece of string between two pegs in the sand or a straight path between two villages. Other ancient cultures, such as the Chinese and Indians, engaged with geometry before the Greeks did, but primarily for practical purposes. In particular, Chinese mathematicians produced visual proofs of geometric facts commonly attributed to the Greeks, like the Pythagorean theorem. It was the Greeks who made geometry abstract. In his collection of books called The Elements, written in the 3rd century BC, Euclid of Alexandria put geometry into a logical framework. Starting from intuitively clear building blocks like points and lines, he made 5 assumptions which we now call axioms or postulates. E1. Exactly one straight line segment may be drawn between any two points. E2. A straight line segment may be extended indefinitely. E3. A circle may be drawn with any given centre and an arbitrary radius. E4. All right angles are equal. E5. If a straight line crossing two line segments makes the interior angles on the same side less than two right angles, the two segments, if extended indefinitely, intersect on the side on which the angles are less than the two right angles. The first three axioms are intuitively clear. The fourth one looks a bit odd, but all it means is that, given two pairs of lines, such that the lines in each pair make a 90 degrees angle with each other, one pair can be rotated and translated to coincide with the second pair. In this chapter and the next, we shall spend some time unveiling the meaning of the fifth axiom, which is equivalent to the following statement. E5. The parallel postulate. Given a line iota and a point capital P not on iota, there is exactly one line which contains capital P and does not intersect iota. Using these axioms, Euclid could define more complicated objects, like triangles. Finally, there came theorems, which are logical consequences of axioms. Some theorems took a long time to prove, while others were intuitively obvious, such as the statement that two distinct straight lines can meet at one point at most. A proof of this may be given by first assuming that the statement is false, and then showing that such an assumption leads to a contradiction. So let us assume that the two lines meet at two points, call them capital P and capital Q. Then there would exist at least two lines through capital P and capital Q, which would, however, contradict the first axiom, E1. Thus our assumption must have been false. This is an example of proof by contradiction, one of the finest weapons at a mathematician's disposal. Another consequence of the axioms is that if a line iota meets two parallel lines M and N, then the opposite angles are equal. If alpha plus gamma were bigger than 180 degrees, the two lines M and N would intersect on the left of iota. This is a consequence of E5. Similarly, if alpha plus gamma were smaller than 180 degrees, then M and N would intersect on the right of iota. Therefore, gamma equals 180 degrees minus alpha. Moreover, beta plus gamma equals 180 degrees, and so alpha equals beta. How can we be sure that some of Euclid's five axioms are not in fact theorems, which can be deduced from a smaller set of axioms? For over two millennia, some followers of Euclid had suspected that Euclid's fifth axiom, the parallel postulate, can be deduced from the first four. The matter was brought to a close in the 19th century by Nikolai Lobachevsky, Janos Bolyai, and Carl Friedrich Gauss, who gave an example of a geometry consistent with the first four axioms, but such that the parallel axiom does not hold. This geometry will be the subject of Chapter 3, and so in the rest of this chapter, we shall focus on Euclidean geometry, where all five axioms are assumed to hold. Compasses and ruler. The geometric shapes singled out by the axioms are line segments and circles. The tools reflecting this in geometric constructions are idealized rulers and compasses. Compasses consist of two rods joined together by a hinge which can be adjusted to any angle between 0 degrees and 180 degrees. One rod can be pinned into any point on the plane, and the other rod ends with a sharp pencil. Thus, circles with arbitrary radii and centres can be drawn. A ruler can be used to draw a straight line segment. It is not graded, meaning that no distances have been marked on the ruler. The Euclidean geometry has no preferred scale. Let us consider a couple of examples of geometric constructions using a ruler and a compass, which are made possible by the axioms bisecting an angle and trisecting a line segment. Given three points, capital A, capital O, capital B, we connect capital A to capital O and capital O to capital B by two line segments and denote the resulting angle by the angle of capital A, capital O, capital B. To bisect this angle, place the point of the compass at the point capital O and draw an arc, capital C, capital D, with point capital C lying on the line segment capital OA and point capital D on the line segment of capital O, capital B. Then draw two more arcs with the radius absolute value of capital C, capital D, one centered at capital C and the other at capital D. These two arcs intersect at two points. The segment connecting these two points can be extended to contain the point capital O. It divides the angle of capital A, capital O, capital B, into two equal angles. The second construction trisects a line segment joining the points capital A and capital B. This problem involves a construction of a point capital P on the line segment capital A, capital B, such that 3, absolute value of capital A, capital P, is equal to the absolute value of capital A, capital B. There are several ways to do this, using a combination of circles and lines. I shall use a method based on 2 circles, 3 lines, and the concept of similar triangles. This can be broken into 6 steps. Step 1. Draw a line segment, capital A, capital C, at an acute angle to the given segment, capital A, capital B, and use postulate E2 to extend capital A, capital C to a line iota. Step 2. Draw a circle with radius absolute value of capital A, capital C, and centre capital C. This circle intersects the line iota containing the segment capital A, capital C in the point capital D. Step 3. Repeat step 2. Construct a circle with the radius of absolute value capital C, capital D, and centre capital D. This circle intersects with the line iota at capital C, and at another point which we shall call capital E. The point capital C trisects the segment capital A, capital E, so that the absolute value of capital A, capital E is equal to 3, absolute value capital A, capital C. Step 4. Connect the points capital E and capital B with a line segment. This gives the triangle with vertices capital A, capital B, and capital E. Step 5. Construct the line parallel to capital B, capital E, and containing capital C. Let capital B be the intersection point of this line with the segment capital A, capital B. Step 6. The triangles capital A, capital E, capital B, and capital A, capital C, capital P are similar. Therefore, the fraction with the numerator, the absolute value of capital A, capital C, and the denominator, the absolute value of capital A, capital E, is equal to the fraction with the numerator, the absolute value of capital A, capital P, and the denominator, the absolute value of capital A, capital B. So, 3 times the absolute value of capital A, capital P, is equal to the absolute value of capital A, capital B. Note that steps 2 and 3 can be repeated any number of times. We can therefore divide a line segment into n parts, where n is any natural number. Or can we? The last step relies on the similarity of triangles and ratios, which we have not proved. It can, however, be deduced from Euclid's axioms. These 2 constructions, bisecting an angle and trisecting a line segment, are not unrelated, as a line segment can be regarded as a limiting case of an angle with 180 degrees. Thus, bisecting a line segment is a special case of bisecting an angle. This suggests that a hybrid construction which the Greeks have attempted, trisecting an angle, may also be possible using only a ruler and compasses. It turns out that it is not, but the proof of impossibility was only given in 1837 by the French mathematician Pierre Voncel. Voncel's methods used a melange of algebra and number theory, both beyond the scope of this book. It is, however, a misconception to conclude that trisecting an angle is impossible. One cannot achieve it using circles and lines, but it can be done using other curves. I shall return to this point in Chapter 6. Lengths and numbers. The angle scale is absolute in Euclidean geometry. Axioms E4 and E5 single out right angles and use them to describe parallel lines. A natural unit of angular measure is the right angle. This can be divided or multiplied to obtain other angles, and the 2 standard units of angle measure are degrees and radians. The radians, although less commonly used than degrees, are preferred by mathematicians as more geometric. 1 radian is the angle subtended at the centre of a circle of radius r by an arc of length r. Radians and degrees are related by 180 degrees is equal to pi radians is equal to 2 right angles. On the other hand, there is no preferred choice for the distance scale. Numbers in Euclidean geometry are expressed in terms of ratios of lengths. For example, the diagonal of a square to its side, or the circumference of a circle to its diameter, rather than directly in terms of lengths. In fact, the notion of a distance does not feature among Euclid's axioms. The choice of a distance scale corresponds to choosing a distance ruler and declaring it to be of unit length. Any other length can then be compared with the unit by rotating and translating the chosen distance ruler in space. A customary distance ruler of choice in North America is an inch. It can be compared with rulers used in continental Europe, called centimetres. An inch is longer, but not in any way more or less fundamental than a centimetre. A ruler preferred by astronomers is called a parsec, and is equal to approximately 3.086 multiplied by 10 to the power of 18 centimetres. The astronomers would measure the ratio of an inch to a centimetre to be around 2.54, and so would nuclear physicists, whose preferred ruler, the Bohr radius of the hydrogen atom, is 5.29 multiplied by 10 to the power of negative 9 centimetres. This is because a ratio of distances is well defined in Euclidean geometry, in that it does not depend on the choice of a distance ruler. To make this more precise, we pick any two distinct points, capital 0 and capital R, in space, and join them by a line, iota, which extends indefinitely. A distance ruler is an identification of this line with the number line, the set of real numbers, such that the point, capital O, corresponds to the number 0, and point, capital R, corresponds to 1. Any other points, capital P and capital Q, on the line iota correspond, by our choice of distance ruler, to real numbers P and Q, which may also be negative, depending on the ordering of the four points, capital O, capital P, capital Q, and capital R, on the line iota. The distance D, open parenthesis capital P, capital Q, close parenthesis, between capital P and capital Q, is then defined to be D, open parenthesis capital P, capital Q, close parenthesis, is equal to the absolute value of P minus Q, where the symbol of two vertical lines denotes the absolute value. The absolute value of x is equal to x if x is greater than or equal to 0, and the absolute value of x is equal to minus x if x is less than 0. So, the absolute value of negative 2 is equal to the absolute value of 2 is equal to 2. In Euclidean geometry, the distance between capital P and capital Q is synonymous with the length of the interval capital P, capital Q, which we shall denote by the absolute value of capital P, capital Q. The notion of the distance resulting from any choice of a distance ruler satisfies D1. D times open parenthesis capital P of capital Q, close parenthesis, is equal to D times open parenthesis capital Q of capital P, close parenthesis. D2. D times open parenthesis capital P of capital Q, close parenthesis, is equal to 0 if and only if capital P equals capital Q. D3. D times open parenthesis capital P of capital Q, close parenthesis, plus D times open parenthesis capital Q of capital S, close parenthesis, is greater than or equal to D times open parenthesis capital P of capital S, close parenthesis. This last property holds for any three points, capital P, capital Q, capital S, not necessarily on the same line. There is no need to choose different distance rulers in different directions, as one distance ruler can be translated and rotated. The property D3 is called the triangle inequality, as it is equivalent to the statement that the sum of the lengths of any two sides of a triangle is greater than the length of the remaining side. In geometry, a transformation is a process of mapping a plane or a space to itself. It can be applied to shapes or collections of points. In Chapter 6, we will discuss a more formal approach based on functions, but in what follows, we shall only consider transformations that preserve distances. Such transformations are called isometries. Each isometry is a combination of rotations, translations, and reflections. Thus, if capital T is an isometry and capital T, open parenthesis, capital P, close parenthesis, denotes the image of point capital P after the isometry has been applied, then D4, D times open parenthesis capital T, open parenthesis capital P, close parenthesis, of capital T times open parenthesis capital Q, close parenthesis, equals D times open parenthesis capital P of capital Q, close parenthesis. Apart from distances, isometries preserve angles and map lines to lines and circles to circles. If two geometric shapes can be transformed into each other by a combination of rotations, translations, and reflections, we call these shapes congruent. I should stress that there are other ways to introduce distance in Euclidean geometry which do not refer to choices of distance rulers. In synthetic geometry, one defines D, open parenthesis, capital P, capital Q, close parenthesis, by the properties D1, D2, D3, together with an assumption that a distance between any two points is non-negative. These three properties alone do not single out the Euclidean distance we defined using the distance ruler. To give a different example of a distance on the plane consistent with D1, D2, D3, pick a point capital O, and for any other points, capital P, capital Q, on the plane, define D, open parenthesis, capital P, capital Q, close parenthesis, is equal to the set of the absolute value of P minus Q over the absolute value of P plus the absolute value of Q. If capital P, capital Q, and capital O lie on the same line. Otherwise, where the right-hand sides of this expression are defined using the Euclidean distance resulting from any choice of the distance ruler with the point capital O corresponding to zero. This notion of the distance is sometimes called the British Rail metric, and the point capital O is referred to as London, from where all train lines radiate. Oxford and Bristol are on the same train line, so their British Rail distance equals the Euclidean distance. A train journey from Oxford to Cambridge is, at the time of writing, necessarily via London, which makes the British Rail distance between the two cities bigger than the Euclidean distance. You may want to verify that the British Rail metric does indeed satisfy the triangle inequality D3, but not D4. Let us return to the Euclidean distance defined by a choice of a ruler, and assume that a point capital P corresponds to a number P on an inch ruler used by Bob. Alice can also examine this point with her parsec ruler and find that it corresponds to a different number. Call it P prime. In fact, for any choice of capital P, the numbers P prime and P are related by P prime equals A times P plus B, where A and B are some real numbers such that A is not equal to zero. The number B corresponds to the arbitrariness in the choice of origin, and A reflects the unit scales being different on the two rulers. In our case, A is around 8.23 times 10 to the power of negative 19. We say that P and P prime are related by an affine transformation. I will have more to say about these transformations in Chapter 6. Bob now chooses four distinct points, capital P, capital Q, capital U, capital V, and computes the ratio of two intervals. The absolute value of capital P times capital Q is to the absolute value of capital U times capital V equals the absolute value of P minus Q divided by the absolute value of U minus V. Alice computes the same ratio using her ruler and finds the fraction with the numerator the absolute value of capital P capital Q and the denominator with the absolute value of capital U capital V is equal to the fraction with the numerator the absolute value of open parenthesis AP plus B close parenthesis minus open parenthesis AQ plus B close parenthesis and the denominator with the absolute value of open parenthesis AU plus B, close parenthesis, minus, open parenthesis, AV plus B, close parenthesis, is equal to the fraction with the numerator with the absolute value of A times the absolute value of P minus Q and the denominator with the absolute value A times the absolute value of U minus V is equal to the fraction with the numerator, the absolute value of P minus Q and the denominator with the absolute value of U minus V. The ambiguity B of the choice of origin has cancelled in both the numerator and denominator, and the scale ambiguity A cancelled upon taking the quotient. Thus, ratios of lengths do not depend on a choice of units, and so neither do the classical geometric constructions, like trisecting the line segment I, described earlier in the chapter. Alice and Bob would agree that New York is approximately 12 times further from Las Vegas than it is from Boston. But to have a constructive discussion about the actual distances, they should agree on the choice of ruler and fix the notion of a unit distance. Let us, from now on, assume that such a choice has been made. Think of two line segments of different lengths. The segments are called commensurable if there exists a line segment of length r, such that both line segments can be partitioned into whole multiples of r. If no such r exists, then the segments are non-commensurable. An example of a non-commensurable segment is a side of a square of length d and a diagonal of this square, which, by the Pythagorean theorem, has length equal to d times the square root of 2. The non-commensurability can be proved by contradiction. If the side and the diagonal were commensurable, then there would exist whole numbers m and n, such that m times r times d is equal to n times r times the square root of 2 times d, or m squared is equal to 2n squared. We can assume that m and n are the smallest such whole numbers, which therefore have no common divisors. Moreover, m squared has to be even, which implies that m is also even, and equal to 2k for some whole number k. Substituting this into the relation gives 2k squared is equal to n squared, which can only hold if n is even, which contradicts our assumption. The conclusion that no m and n can exist led to difficulties for the Pythagoreans, who used whole numbers, which we shall also call integers, like 1, 2, 7, 44, as well as rational numbers like 2 over 7 or m over n, where m and n are both integers, and n does not equal 0. How then can one account for a number x which corresponds to the length of the diagonal of the unit square? By the Pythagorean theorem, this number must satisfy x squared is equal to 1 plus 1 equals 2. But the Pythagoreans could prove, perhaps using the argument we gave before, that no integers m and n can exist, such that m squared divided by n squared equals 2. Using modern terminology, the value of x, the square root of 2, is an irrational number. While this must have been a blow to the Pythagoreans, the square root of 2 was still accepted as a length. Moreover, although the intervals with lengths 1 and the square root of 2 are not commensurable, the length, the square root of 2, relative to a unit distance can be constructed by using a compass and ruler, as it is possible to construct a square with any given side. It turns out, although it was only proved in the 19th century, that it is not possible to give such a construction for the cube root of 2. This problem, known as the duplication of the cube, was one of the three problems of antiquity. The other two were trisecting an angle and constructing a square with the same area as that of a given circle. Legend has it that the oracle at Delphi ordered the size of the cube-shaped altar dedicated to Apollo to be doubled. Plato was consulted, but could not solve the problem using a ruler and compasses. If we declare the side of the original cube to be 1, then the doubled cube will have side x, where x cubed is equal to 2 times 1 cubed, or x equals the cube root of 2. The argument we used to prove that the square root of 2 is irrational can also be used to establish the irrationality of the cube root of 2, and therefore its non-commensurability with the side of the cube. This alone does not rule out a compass and ruler construction, as, after all, that is possible for only the square root of 2. To see what is going on, let us examine more closely the algebraic operations involved in constructing commensurable segments. We shall say that a positive number x is constructible if, and only if, given a line segment of unit length, a line segment of length x can be constructed by a finite iteration of ruler and compass constructions. In this way, we can construct points as intersections of either two lines, a line and a circle, or two circles, assuming that the lines and circles have already been determined from the initial unit line segment. The number 1 is constructible, and so is any other number which can be obtained by applying square roots and 4 arithmetic operations, plus, minus, times, divide, to constructible numbers. Thus, the numbers, the square root of 2, 3, times the fraction with the numerator 2 and the denominator 13, the square root of 17 plus the fraction with the numerator 1 and the denominator 3, times the square root of 11 plus the square root of 5 minus 1, are all constructible. Let us focus on the last one of these and call it x. By reversing the allowed operations, first add 1 to x, square the answer, subtract 17, etc., we find that x is a root of a polynomial equation of degree 8. Open parenthesis, 3, open parenthesis, x plus 1, close parenthesis, squared, minus 17, close parenthesis, squared, minus 11, close parenthesis, squared, minus 5, equals 0. In general, constructible numbers are roots of polynomial equations with integer coefficients whose degree, the highest power of x appearing in the equation, is equal to some power of 2. This takes care of reversing all operations involving square roots. Moreover, these equations should be irreducible in the sense that they do not factor into lower degree polynomials with integer coefficients. Therefore, the cube root of 2 is not constructible, as the polynomial equation, x cubed minus 2 equals 0, is of degree 3, and 3 is not a power of 2. The number the cube root of 2 also satisfies a degree 4 equation. X to the power of 4 plus x cubed minus 2x minus 2 equals 0. But this equation can be rewritten as open parenthesis x cubed minus 2 close parenthesis times open parenthesis x plus 1 close parenthesis equals 0. And so it is reducible. Is the circumference of a circle commensurable with its diameter? Let us use the symbol pi, which is the ratio of the circumference to the diameter. It turns out that neither pi nor the square root of pi arises as a root of any polynomial equation with integer coefficient. Such numbers are transcendental, and none of them are commensurable with the unit. The transcendence in particular implies that pi is irrational. But even demonstrating the irrationality of pi alone is far more difficult than the argument we gave for the square root of 2. This also proves that squaring the circle is impossible with a ruler and compasses construction. Say that the radius of the circle is 1, so that its area is pi. The side of a square with the same area is the square root of pi, but this number is also transcendental. This follows from the transcendence of pi. The number pi can, however, be approximated by rational numbers. The value 22 divided by 7 already gives a result correct to 2 decimal places. Archimedes of Syracuse sandwiched a circle between 2 polygons, one inscribed inside a circle and one circumscribed about a circle. Calculating both perimeters gives an upper and a lower bound for pi. Using polygons with 96 sides leads to 3 times the fraction with the numerator 10 and the denominator 71 is less than pi, is less than 3 times the fraction with the numerator 1 and the denominator 7. Taking the average of the upper and the lower bound gives pi is equal to 3.14185, which is correct up to 3 decimal places. Polygons and tilings, from Plato to Penrose. A polygon is a plane shape bounded by segments of straight lines. It is called convex if any two points inside the polygon can be connected by a line segment contained inside the polygon. The simplest polygon is a triangle. I shall use the Euclid axioms to prove that the sum of its internal angles is 180 degrees. Let alpha, beta, gamma be the angles emanating from the three vertices, capital A, capital B, capital C. The axiom E2 allows us to extend the segment capital A, capital B to a line iota. The fifth axiom in the form E5 implies that there exists the unique line M which goes through capital C and is parallel to iota. Using the properties of the opposite angles which we have already established from the axioms, we find alpha plus beta plus gamma equals 180 degrees. Any convex polygon with n sides, we shall call such polygons n-gons, can be partitioned into open parenthesis n minus 2 close parenthesis triangles. The sum of the angles in any of the triangles is 180 degrees, which gives the sum of all internal angles of the convex n-gon to be open parenthesis n minus 2 close parenthesis times 180 degrees. A polygon is called regular if all its segments have equal length and meet at equal angles. Thus, an equilateral triangle is a regular three-gon, and a square is a regular four-gon. The next three are pentagon, hexagon, and heptagon. All internal angles are equal in a regular polygon, and there are n of them. Thus, an internal angle is the total sum of all angles divided by n, which gives the expression for an internal angle. Alpha equals 180 degrees minus the fraction with the numerator 360 degrees and the denominator n. Any equilateral triangle, a square, and a regular pentagon can all be constructed using a ruler and compasses by inscribing them in a circle. Moreover, if a regular polygon can be constructed in that way, then so can a polygon with twice the number of sides. It is not possible to construct all regular polygons with the aid of a ruler and compass. This, together with a criterion for the n-gons to be constructible, was established by the German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss when he was 19 years old. A regular polygon can be constructed with compass and ruler if, and only if, the number of its sides is a product of a power of 2 and any number of different prime numbers of the form 2 squared to the power of m plus 1, where m is a natural number. The first five prime numbers of this form are 3, 5, 17, 257, 65,537. Thus, for example, a regular 9-gon cannot be constructed with compass and ruler, as 9 equals 3 times 3, so that m equals 0, but 3 is not a power of 2. Let us examine a honeycomb made by bees. The regular pattern of the honeycomb can be repeated indefinitely, to cover the whole plane with regular hexagons, with no gaps or overlaps. A pattern with this property is called a tiling. Circles could be used instead, but would leave gaps between them. This would not be a tiling. The bees could have also chosen a tiling with squares or equilateral triangles, but the hexagonal tiling uses the least amount of material to create perimeters between cells of a given area. In this way, more honey can fit in. Aren't the bees clever? Apart from using regular hexagons, squares and equilateral triangles, it is not possible to tile a plane with any other regular n-gons of one type. To tile the plane, the internal angle alpha of a regular polygon must divide 360 degrees, as otherwise it would not be possible for a whole number of the polygons to meet at a point and leave no gaps. The equation K times alpha equals 360 degrees has only three solutions with integers n and k. Open parenthesis n equals 3 times k equals 6 is two triangles, close parenthesis. Open parenthesis n equals 4, k equals 4 is two squares, close parenthesis. And open parenthesis n equals 6, k equals 3 is to hexagons, close parenthesis. More tilings are possible if we relax some of the conditions. Tilting and stretching the square tiling gives a tiling with identical parallelograms. Allowing more than one type of regular polygons leads to infinitely many possibilities, some of which were used by medieval Islamic artists in floral wall coverings. These tilings are all periodic, in the sense that translating all tiles in two non-parallel directions by a fixed distance gives a tiling identical to the original. For example, the square tiling from figure 18, located in the print version of this book, can be translated up, down, left or right by a distance equal to the side of a square, or diagonally by the square root of 2 times the side length. A plain tiling with no period and such that it does not contain arbitrarily large periodic parts is called aperiodic. Such a tiling cannot be created by taking one of its sections and repeating it. There is some evidence that aperiodic tilings were known to Islamic artists, and an example of such a tiling can be found on the Darb-e-Imam shrine in Isfahan, Iran. In 1974, the British mathematician and theoretical physicist Roger Penrose came up with several systematic methods of covering an entire plane in an aperiodic way. One of these involves two shapes of tiles, fat and thin rhombi, with equal sides but different angles. The internal angles are 72 degrees and 108 degrees in the fat rhombi, and 36 degrees and 144 degrees in the thin rhombi. Both the fat and thin rhombi will separately tile the plane, so the two types of tiles must be supplemented by matching rules, which guarantee that the resulting tiling is aperiodic. Where this rule for the rhombi is presented, the similarly shaded parts are matched against each other. Equipped with a large set of tiles of both types, you now try to arrange them following the rules and cover a larger and larger region. You can nevertheless get stuck and reach a stage where no more tiles can be added. Then you need to backtrack and make different choices along the way. The choices leading to a tiling are not unique, and there are infinitely many patterns built from both rhombi. As the tiling is expanded to cover a larger area, the ratio of the quantities of the fat rhombi to the quantities of the thin rhombi approaches the golden ratio. The fraction with the numerator 1 plus the square root of 5 and the denominator 2 is equal to 1.618. This can be turned into a proof that this tiling is indeed non-periodic, because for any periodic tiling the ratio would be a rational number, as the ratio of some finite number of fat and thin rhombi, and the golden ratio is irrational. Another property of Penrose's aperiodic tilings is their non-locality. Imagine that, having built a patch covering a large portion of the plane, you need to make two choices for how to place two tiles at opposite ends of the patch, which may be billions of units away from each other, where the side length of any rhombi is 1. It turns out that the choice you make at one end of the patch uniquely determines the type of tile which needs to be placed at the other end. Thus, there is no local algorithm which, if followed, will lead to a tiling. Aperiodic tilings occur in nature in the form of quasi-crystals, whose existence was conjectured by Penrose. In the mid-1980s, non-periodic atomic structures of crystals were indeed discovered by Dan Schechtman, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for this in 2011. It is still not known whether there exists an aperiodic tiling of a plane with only one type of tile. Platonic solids. Analogues of polygons, but in space, are called polyhedra. A polyhedron is bounded by planes forming the faces. The meeting of two faces is called an edge, and edges intersect at a vertex. We shall assume that all polyhedra are convex, meaning that a segment joining any pair of points inside a polyhedron lies entirely within that polyhedron. A polyhedron is called irregular, or a platonic solid, if all its faces are identical regular polygons. Thus, the same number of edges meets at each vertex, and the angles between any two edges are the same. The names of the Platonic solids reflect the Greek words for the number of faces. A tetrahedron has four faces, which are equilateral triangles. A hexahedron, commonly known as a cube, has six faces, which are squares. An octahedron has eight faces, which are equilateral triangles. A dodecahedron has 12 faces, which are regular pentagons. And an icosahedron has 20 faces, which are equilateral triangles. These five solids played a role in ancient Greek philosophy. The four elements, fire, earth, air, and water, corresponded to tetrahedron, cube, octahedron, and icosahedron, respectively. The dodecahedron represented the heavenly firmament. There are no other Platonic solids apart from the five in Figure 20. To prove this, suppose that F is the number of faces meeting at each vertex, and that each face is that of a regular n-gon. Both F and N are clearly greater than or equal to 3. The sum of angles at a vertex of a polyhedron is less than 360 degrees, as unfolding a vertex and its adjacent faces onto the plane necessarily leaves a gap. Therefore, using our formula for the internal angles of a polygon gives open parenthesis 180 degrees minus the fraction with the numerator 360 degrees and the denominator n, close parenthesis, multiplied by f is less than 360 degrees, which, with some algebra, can be arranged into the inequality open parenthesis n minus 2, close parenthesis, times open parenthesis f minus 2, close parenthesis, is less than 4. It follows that open parenthesis n minus 2, close parenthesis, and open parenthesis f minus 2, close parenthesis, are positive integers whose product is smaller than 4. There are only 5 such pairs of integers. Open parenthesis 1, 1, close parenthesis, open parenthesis 1, 2, close parenthesis, open parenthesis 2, 1, close parenthesis, open parenthesis 1, 3, close parenthesis, open parenthesis 3, 1, close parenthesis, which gives n equals 3, f equals 3, tetrahedron, vertices equals 4, edges equals 6, faces equals 4, n equals 4, f equals 3, cube, vertices equals 8, edges equals 12, faces equals 6, n equals 3, f equals 4, octahedron, vertices equals 6, edges equals 12, faces equals 8, n equals 5, f equals 3, dodecahedron, vertices equals 20, edges equals 30, faces equals 12, n equals 3, f equals 5, icosahedron, vertices equals 12, edges equals 30, faces equals 20. These values are different for each Platonic solid, but in each case they are related by the formula vertices minus edges plus faces equals 2. This formula remains true for any polyhedron. It was discovered by the 18th century Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler, and the formula now carries Euler's name. To see why it is true, imagine inscribing a cube inside a sphere and continuously pushing the faces of the cube onto the surface of the sphere in a way which preserves the number of faces, edges, and vertices. In this way, the cube is turned into 6 regions on the sphere divided by the 12 boundaries, meeting at 8 points. Each polyhedron can be given such a spherical representation. We can aim to construct an arbitrary polyhedron by drawing a polygon on the sphere consisting of intersecting arc and adding more edges to it. At the first step, when there is only one such polygon, we have capital F equals 2. One face is the polygon itself, and the other one is its complement on the sphere. And capital V equals capital E. As for one polygon, the number of vertices equals the number of edges. Therefore, capital V minus capital E plus capital F equals 2, and the Euler formula holds. Attaching additional edges can then be accomplished in two ways. 1. Add a new vertex and draw an edge joining it to one of the existing vertices. This increases both capital V and capital E by 1 and does not change capital F, so the Euler formula remains valid. 2. Add a new edge and connect it to two already existing vertices. This increases capital F and capital E by 1 and does not change capital V, and the Euler formula is not affected. As a projection of any polyhedron onto a sphere can be reconstructed by successive applications of 1 and 2, the Euler formula holds for all polyhedra. A remarkable symmetry relates different platonic solids to each other. Take a platonic solid capital P and join the midpoints of all adjacent faces by edges. This gives a new polyhedron inscribed in capital P called the dual of capital P, which is also platonic. This duality interchanges the numbers of vertices and faces and leaves the number of edges intact. Moreover, if the process is repeated twice, the original platonic solid is recovered. The dual of the icosahedron is the dodecahedron, and the dual of the octahedron is the cube. The tetrahedron is self-dual, as the duality operation produces another tetrahedron. The platonic solids occur in nature. The tetrahedron, cube, and octahedron appear in crystal structures, and all five appear as shapes of some microorganisms and viruses. There are molecules of carbon which are polyhedra with 20 hexagonal and 12 pentagonal faces, 60 vertices, and 90 edges. This configuration, which satisfies the Euler formula, is called a fullerene and is named after the 20th century American architect Richard Buckminster Fuller, who designed dome structures in which the hexagons and pentagons are further divided into triangles. Areas. Our intuitive concept of the area of a geometric shape as the amount of paint needed to cover the shape is a good one, as long as we exclude some pathological cases. This task turns out to be difficult and has evolved into a separate branch of mathematics called measure theory. I shall first consider only polygonal shapes which can be bounded by a finite collection of line segments. The area of a polygonal shape, capital S, is a non-negative real number called area, capital S, which satisfies three axioms. A1. If capital S and capital U are two polygons with no points in common, then the area of the union of capital S and capital U is equal to the area of capital S plus the area of capital U. A2. The area of a rectangle with sides A and B is A times B. A3. Any congruent polygons have the same area. These axioms define area by its properties, not an uncommon approach in mathematics. They lead to constructive methods to compute areas. For example, let us compute the area of a triangle with vertices capital A, capital B, capital C. Rotate the triangle by 180 degrees about the midpoint of the segment capital A, capital C. This gives a parallelogram whose area is equal to twice the area of the triangle. Here we are using A3 followed by A1. This area is equal to that of a rectangle with base capital B, capital C and height H. To see it, shift the right-angled triangles and again refer to A1. Finally, A2 gives the area of triangle capital A, capital B, capital C is equal to half A times H. We can also deduce from the axioms that if a polygon capital S is contained in a polygon capital U, then the area of capital S is not greater than the area of capital U. To see this, write capital U equals the union of capital S and, open parenthesis, capital U excluding capital S, close parenthesis, where capital U excluding capital S is the complement of the set capital S in the set capital U. It consists of all elements of capital U which are not elements of capital S. The two sets capital S and capital U excluding capital S have no points in common, so A1 gives the area of capital U is equal to the area of capital S plus the area of capital U excluding capital S, is greater than or equal to the area of capital S, as the area of capital U excluding capital S is non-negative by definition. The property we have just established allows us to prove that the area of a line segment is zero. Indeed, a line segment of length A can be enclosed inside a rectangle with sides of lengths A plus epsilon and epsilon, where epsilon is any positive number which we can take to be as small as we like. Therefore, the area of the line segment is not greater than open parenthesis A plus epsilon close parenthesis times epsilon by A2. But this number can be made arbitrarily small by taking the limit epsilon approaches zero. To appreciate the need to exclude the pathologies I alluded to before formulating the axioms, let us consider two shapes which we shall call capital R and capital J. The shape capital R consists of all straight line segments which go through the centre of a unit square, have endpoints on the opposite edges of this square, and form angles which are rational numbers with the horizontal line through the centre of the square. The shape capital J consists of all such line segments, where the angles are irrational. We shall for convenience declare that the centre of the square belongs to capital R and not capital J. In this way, any point on the square belongs to either capital J or capital R, so that the square is the union of capital J and capital R. What then is the area of capital R? Any line segment in capital J is arbitrarily close to a line segment in capital R, as an irrational angle can be approximated by a rational angle with an arbitrary precision, for example by truncating the decimal expansion of the angle. If we use red paint to colour capital R, the whole square will look red. Is the area of capital R equal to 1? Or is it 0, as we have already shown that any line segment has 0 area? Or is it perhaps a half? The regions capital J and capital R are not polygonal, so we should give up hope of assigning an area to either of them. We should be worried that by trying to exclude the anomalies like capital R and capital J, we have made it impossible to define areas for shapes like circles and other regions enclosed by curves. A circle is not a polygon, but it can be approximated by one with arbitrary precision. In the first approximation, consider a circle of radius r inscribed in a square of side 2r. The area of this square is 4r squared. So if a circle has an area which can be made sense of, it should be less than that. We instead take a square inscribed in the same circle. This smaller square has a diagonal of length 2r and a side of length r times the square root of 2. So its area is 2r squared. Thus, the area of a circle with radius r should be a number between 2r squared and 4r squared. This crude approximation can be improved by sandwiching a circle between two regular n-gons, one inscribed inside a circle and one circumscribed about a circle, and obtaining lower and upper bounds for the area in that way. As n gets bigger, the approximation improves. In the limit where n tends to infinity, the area of the region between two polygons tends to zero, and the area of both polygons tends to the area of the circle. A regular n-gon inscribed inside a circle of radius r consists of n isosceles triangles, each with base d sub n. In the limit when n is large, the total area of these triangles tends to the area capital A of the circle, so that n times open parenthesis the fraction with the numerator 1 and the denominator 2 times r times d sub n close parenthesis approaches capital A when n approaches infinity. The circumference capital C equals 2 pi times r of the circle is the limit of n times d sub n as n tends to infinity. So the two formulae together give capital A is equal to the fraction with the numerator 1 and the denominator 2 times r times capital C, or capital A is equal to pi times r squared. To make this procedure more formal and to allow for shapes enclosed by other smooth surfaces, we can go back to squares and rectangles. Draw such a shape, capital S, on graph paper, and count the number of squares contained inside the shape. This gives a lower bound for the area. Including the squares which enclose the perimeter of the shape gives the upper bound. As the grid of the graph paper gets smaller, these upper and lower bounds tend to limits. If these limits exist and are equal, then they define the area of capital S, which, by its construction, is non-negative and satisfies the axioms A1, A2, A3. For general shapes, the upper and lower bounds may still tend to limits, which may, however, be different. In this case, no notion of area which satisfies A1, A2, A3 can be assigned to capital S. Cartesian coordinates. The advancement of Euclidean geometry has revealed properties of geometric shapes, such as cones, circles, and platonic solids. The methodology was to examine these shapes and their areas, interior angles, and distances between vertices. Until the 17th century, however, it was not clear what a geometric shape was. The shapes were defined by their properties. For example, a sphere consists of all points which are equidistant from a fixed point called the centre. A triangle is a polygon with three edges and three vertices. More exotic shapes were given catchy names, like the curve known as the Witch of Agnesi, studied by the 18th century Italian mathematician Maria Agnesi. To construct the witch, consider two points, capital O and capital B, on the plane, and draw a circle with diameter capital O, capital B. For any point capital C on this circle, let capital D be the point of intersection of the secant line, capital O, capital C, and the tangent line to the circle at capital B. Now draw a perpendicular to the diameter capital O, capital B, through the point capital C. Let capital P be the point of intersection of this perpendicular with the line parallel to capital O, capital B, through capital D. Different choices of points capital C on the circle will lead to different capital P's, and the locus of all points capital P is the Witch of Agnesi. There were many more shapes with similarly beautiful geometric constructions, but a modern definition of a geometric shape, as a set of points on the plane or in space, could not have been formulated until the end of the 19th century, when the set theory was developed. Geometry was in crisis as the precise subject of its research was blurred. The resolution was provided by the French philosopher and mathematician René Descartes, also known as Cartesius. In his La Géométrie, published in 1637, he married geometry with algebra. This eventually gave rise to a universal description of all geometric shapes by equations. The idea was to introduce a coordinate system. Three pairwise perpendicular oriented straight lines, iota sub 1, iota sub 2, and iota sub 3, intersecting at one point called the origin capital O. Any point capital P in space is then uniquely described by three ordered numbers, P1, P2, P3, called coordinates, where the P1 coordinate is the distance, taken with the appropriate sign of a perpendicular projection from capital P to iota sub 1, with analogous constructions of P2 and P3. Conversely, specifying three coordinates uniquely determines a point in space. If capital Q is another point with coordinates Q1, Q2, Q3, then the distance between capital P and capital Q is given by the formula D, open parenthesis, capital P, capital Q, close parenthesis, equals the square root of, open parenthesis, P1 minus Q1, close parenthesis, squared, plus open parenthesis, P2 minus Q2, close parenthesis, squared, plus open parenthesis, P3 minus Q3, close parenthesis, squared. This is the Pythagorean theorem expressed in the Cartesian coordinate system. Geometric shapes can then be defined as algebraic relations between the coordinates of their points. For example, a sphere of radius R centered at the origin capital O, with coordinates 0, 0, 0, consists of all points capital P, such that D of capital P capital 0 equals R, or if the coordinates of capital P are x, y, z, x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals r squared. The Witch of Agnesi, depicted in figure 22, located in the print version of this book, has equation open parenthesis x squared plus b squared close parenthesis times y equals b cubed, where b equals the absolute value of capital O capital B is the diameter of the circle used to define the witch, and we have chosen the point capital O to be the origin and the point capital B to have coordinates 0, B. The witch is then the set of all points capital B with coordinates x, y, which satisfy this equation. Higher dimensions. The approach to geometry which replaces the ruler and compass constructions by equations is called analytic geometry. Note that, as the witch lies on a plane, it is sufficient to use only two coordinates instead of three. The Cartesian coordinate system in this case is the XY plane, which you may recall from school. While the surface of the sphere is a shape embedded in three dimensions, a curve like the Witch of Agnesi is a shape embedded in two dimensions. How about geometric shapes in higher dimensions? Most, but by no means all, professional mathematicians find visualizing higher dimensions as difficult as non-mathematicians do. Analytic geometry offers a remedy. Points on the plane can be identified with pairs of real numbers. We therefore denote the plane by the set of real numbers squared is equal to the set of real numbers times the set of real numbers, where capital R is the set of all real numbers, and the symbol x is called the Cartesian product. Similarly, the Euclidean space, the set of all real numbers times the set of all real numbers times the set of all real numbers, is denoted by the set of all real numbers cubed. Its points correspond to triples of real numbers. Four-dimensional space, the set of all real numbers to the power of 4, can therefore be defined as the set of quadruples of real numbers. A point in the set of all real numbers to the power of 4 is uniquely specified by its four coordinates, p1, p2, p3, p4. There is no need to imagine what the fourth dimension looks like, as long as one is willing to do the algebra. Somewhat less formally, each dimension corresponds to a degree of freedom which can be varied without altering the remaining dimensions. For any natural number n, we define points in n-dimensional Euclidean space as lists of n real numbers, p1, p2, and so on, pn. The adjective Euclidean refers to the fact that an extension of the familiar Pythagorean theorem still holds and can be used to define the distance between two points, capital P and capital Q, in the set of real numbers to the power of n as d of capital P capital Q equals the square root of open parenthesis P1 minus Q1, close parenthesis squared, plus open parenthesis P2 minus Q2, close parenthesis squared, plus, and so on, plus open parenthesis PN minus QN, close parenthesis squared. This analytic approach to higher dimensions enables us to answer seemingly impossible questions like, what is the intersection of two spheres of unit radius in five dimensions whose centres are a unit distance apart? Without a blink, first extend the definition of the sphere of unit radius to the set of real numbers to the power of 5. It is the set of all points with coordinates x, y, z, u, w, such that x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus u squared plus w squared equals 1. Where I have chosen the Cartesian coordinate system so that the centre of this sphere is at the origin. I shall now take the centre of the second sphere to be the point with coordinates 0, 0, 0, 0, 1 in the set of real numbers to the power of 5. In this way, the two centres are at a unit distance apart. This sphere is also required to have radius 1, so its equation is x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus u squared plus open parenthesis w minus 1, close parenthesis squared, equals 1, where we have used the Pythagorean theorem to compute the squared distance between the centre and points on the sphere. To find the intersection of the two spheres, we need to determine all points with coordinates that satisfy both equations. This can be done by subtracting the second equation from the first. Simple algebra then gives W equals 1 divided by 2. Substituting this value of W back into either of the equations yields x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus u squared equals the fraction with the numerator 3 and the denominator 4. This is an equation of a sphere of radius the square root of 3 divided by 2 in four-dimensional space. Thus, a sphere in a four-dimensional space is the intersection of the two spheres in our problem. Easy? Given some practice with algebraic manipulations, it actually is quite straightforward. A more interesting question is whether these manipulations still amount to geometry. There are purists among geometers who would prefer to stick to rulers, compasses, and pictorial intersections of shapes. A possible objection to the analytic methods could also be that the results seem to depend on various choices that we made along the way. Would we still have obtained a sphere in four dimensions as the answer to our question if we had positioned the centres of our two spheres at different points? This is a valid question, but it turns out that all possible choices lead to the same answer, the only difference being a possibly shifted centre for the resulting sphere. We shall return to this point in Chapter 6, when we discuss geometry from the point of view of groups of transformations. Progress in geometry is often made using a combination of classical and analytic approaches. Pictorial representation leads to an intuition which may suggest that the answer could be an explicit computation using Cartesian coordinates allows us to pin down the details and get further information, like the radius, the square root of 3 divided by 2 of the sphere in our example. Vectors. Vectors are a relatively recent concept going back to the 19th century, and vector methods are most effective when combined with the notion and formalism of algebra as employed in geometry. A vector is an arrow attached to a point in space. If two arrows have the same length and point in the same direction, then they represent the same vector. I shall denote vectors by bold symbols, U, V. To add two vectors, U and V, take the arrow V and move it in space without changing its direction or length until its tail touches the head of the arrow U. Then join the tail of U to the head of V by an oriented line segment. The result of this operation is a vector denoted by U plus V. By instead moving the arrow U to the head of V, we can convince ourselves that, for all vectors U and V, V1. Addition is commutative. U plus V equals V plus U. Adding two vectors of the same length but with opposite direction gives the zero vector 0, which has no direction, has zero length, and satisfies V2. There exists a zero vector 0 such that U plus 0 equals U. The Cartesian coordinate system makes vector addition particularly simple. Let us say that a vector U is the arrow joining two points, capital P and capital Q, in the Euclidean space, the set of all real numbers cubed, with its tail at capital P and its head at capital Q. This vector is justifiably called capital P, capital Q. If the Cartesian coordinates of capital P and capital Q are P1, P2, P3, and Q1, Q2, Q3, then the vector capital P, capital Q can be represented by a triple of numbers called the vector components, Q1 minus P1, Q2 minus P2, Q3 minus P3, which are the differences between the coordinates of capital P and capital Q. This leads to another perspective on vectors, this time in arbitrary dimension n, as n tuples of numbers. The components of the vector u plus v arise as the sum of components of u and v, which makes property v1 obvious. We can not only add vectors to each other, but also multiply them by numbers. This has an effect of changing the length of a vector and either keeping its direction for a positive multiple or reversing the direction for a negative multiple. For example, if u equals open parenthesis 1, negative 3, 2, close parenthesis, then 3u equals open parenthesis 3, negative 9, 6, close parenthesis, and negative 2u equals open parenthesis negative 2, 6, negative 4, close parenthesis. The branch of mathematics called linear algebra is devoted to the study of vectors as abstract objects which can be added to each other and multiplied by numbers in a way which satisfies a number of axioms, including V1 and V2. In linear algebra, we are not concerned with how vectors arise in space. Vectors are especially useful in mechanics, where they represent quantities like velocity, acceleration, and force, which have a magnitude and a direction. Other quantities, such as temperature or mass, which do not have a direction, are called scalars. Adopting vectors in mechanics pays off when there are several forces acting on an object. Rather than analysing the effect of each force separately, we add the corresponding vectors to each other. The sum of these vectors is the net force, capital F. According to Newton's second law, capital F equals M times A. The acceleration A resulting from this force is the vector obtained by multiplying capital F by a scalar 1 divided by m, where m is the mass of the object. Hard problems with easy statements. Euclid's Elements has, until recently, been used for teaching geometry at high school and university levels. The text was written about 2,300 years ago, and while it is not free of fallacies, Euclid made some implicit assumptions about the ordering of points on line segments and about continuity, which were later added to the set of axioms, most of it is correct. These books are here to stay. Imagine teaching biology, chemistry, or physics from a text of similar age. In these fields, anything written more than 50 years ago is regarded as outdated and often wrong. This is because the science is moving forward, and yet geometry is also moving forward. I will have more to say about this in the subsequent chapters, but once a correct proof of a theorem, such as the existence of 5 Platonic solids, has been presented, it becomes timeless. The theorem itself may generalise to other geometries or dimensions. Indeed, such generalisations is what some professional mathematicians occupy themselves with, but none of this invalidates the original proof. Geometry is not unlike philosophy, where writings of the old masters are still studied, but this comparison may be unfair on both fields. You can either agree or disagree with the views of Immanuel Kant, and make a career out of this, as long as your arguments are presented in a coherent and eloquent way. Try, on the other hand, to disagree with the ancient Greeks and argue that the square root of 2 is rational after all. Perhaps art is a better analogy. Most would recognise the harmony of Leonardo da Vinci's work as timeless. There may be more to this comparison than meets the eye, and I shall return to it in Chapter 5. While many theorems in geometry have been established by building on Euclid's axioms, there are still questions which are relatively easy to state, but less easy to settle. Many of these questions look like curious puzzles from a collection of recreational mathematics problems. It is remarkable that there is no straightforward way of deciding whether a geometric problem is just hard, but doable by a smart high school student with a clever idea, or one of the problems which professional mathematicians have tried to crack for decades or more. With this remark in mind, I invite listeners to reflect on the following three problems. Problem 1. Given any configuration of n points in the plane which do not all lie on one straight line, must there always be a straight line which contains only 2 points? Problem 2. Can one paint a plane with 3 colours, such that every point has some colour, and so that no 2 points with the same colour are a unit distance apart? Problem 3. Attempt once you have solved problem 2. What is the minimum number of colours needed to paint a plane so that no 2 points of the same colour are a unit distance apart? Problem 1 was posed by James Joseph Sylvester, one of the most prominent English mathematicians of the 19th century. Sylvester could not solve it, and nor could anyone else until the mid-1930s. The following elementary proof was found in 1948 by Leroy Milton Kelly. Let capital C be the set of all points in problem 1. Consider all pairs consisting of a point capital P in the set capital C and a line iota that contains 2 other points in capital C, Call them capital Q and capital R, but misses capital P. The set capital C has finitely many elements, and so there are also finitely many lines which connect points in capital C. Therefore, there are finitely many such pairs, capital P iota, and we can pick one pair such that the distance from capital P to iota is the smallest. Then the line iota contains only two points. Otherwise, apart from capital Q and capital R, there would be at least one more point, capital S, on iota, and at least two out of the three points, capital Q, capital R, and capital S, must lie on the same side of the perpendicular joining the point capital P to the line iota. Let us say that these two points are capital R and capital S, and that capital R is closer to the perpendicular than capital S. Then the distance from capital R to the line containing capital P and capital S is shorter than the distance from capital P to iota. However, this is a contradiction, as we had assumed that the pair capital P iota minimizes all possible distances between points and lines. Therefore, no points other than capital Q and capital R can lie on the line iota, and the Sylvester problem is answered affirmatively. This proof, apart from solving problem one, demonstrates that elementary solutions may take a while to be found, an encouragement to amateur problem solvers who are often frowned upon by mathematicians. In fact, there can be more than one line with the property that is mentioned in Sylvester's problem. It can be shown that, for any given number n, the number of such lines is at least 3n divided by 7. It is not known whether this bound can be improved. The second problem is hard. While most people faced with it will sooner or later start drawing circles of unit radius, it is tricky to come up with a systematic way of doing it, which shows that the answer to problem 2 is a no. And yet once the solution is revealed to them, they admit that it is very simple. Let us assume that it is possible to paint the plane with just three colours, call them red, blue and white, in a way that is consistent with the requirements of problem 2. Consider a point capital P on the plane. Say it is white and draw a circle capital C with unit radius centred at this point. All points on this circle have to be red or blue. Pick any two points on the circle which are a unit distance apart. One of them has to be red and the other blue, so we produced an equilateral triangle of unit side and such that all the vertices of this triangle have different colours. Now reflect the white vertex in a line containing the blue and the red vertex. The resulting point must also be white. But this is true for all equilateral triangles constructed by picking two points on capital C, which are a unit distance apart. Therefore, a circle entered at capital P and with radius the square root of 3 consists of points which are all white, and by taking a chord of unit length of this bigger circle, we have constructed two white points which are a unit distance apart. We have now reached a contradiction, as originally we assumed that no such points can exist. This assumption must have been wrong. It is not possible to colour the plane with only three colours, as in problem 2. The solution to problem 3 is not known. The number of colours that the problem asks for is called the chromatic number of the plane. The solution of problem 2 shows that this number is at least 4. It is not greater than 7, which can be seen by considering the tiling of the plane with regular hexagons of side length D. Let us call the 7 colours at our disposal, 1, 2, up to 7, and paint one of the hexagons with colour 1 and its 6 neighbouring hexagons with colours 2 to 7 in the clockwise direction, such that 7 is immediately on the left of 1. Now translate this colouring to cover the whole plane. Then an application of the Pythagorean theorem shows that no two points of colour 1 are at a unit distance apart if the square root of 7 divided by 7 is less than D, which is less than 1 divided by 2, so that picking D is equal to 3 divided by 7 does the job. Therefore, the chromatic number of the plane is 4, 5, 6 or 7. This was the state of play until 2018, when a biologist and amateur mathematician, Aubrey de Grey, showed that this number cannot be 4. He did it by a computer-assisted construction of a collection of 1,581 points on the plane, which required 5 colours to avoid pairs of same-coloured points, which are a unit distance apart. It is still not known what the chromatic number of a plane is.